Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and Anthony Oliveira, PhD, writer, and dumpster raccoon. You'd think that bands like Zeppelin releasing iconic tracks like Ramble On and Black Sabbath debuting their first album in 1970, their endurance would be reflected on the Billboard charts of that year. But something happened in 1969. Maybe it was Altamont, like so many things are blamed on, but the American Billboard chart took a hard turn towards Christian music. Were people growing tired of the debauchery preached by the Stones and wanted a more uplifting lyric? Sending tracks like Norman Greenbaum's Spirit in the Sky and, of course, the Doobie Brothers' Jesus is Just All Right to the top of the charts, and keeping them there. Adding a driving beat and electric guitar to traditional Christian religious songs made them bona fide hits in 70 to roughly 72, and that carried over into Broadway and songs from our two movies today that topped charts and launched careers. Anthony, why do you think the Christian religious movement of the early 70s inspired two of the biggest musical theater composers of all time? Like, we're talking Stephen Schwartz and Andrew Lloyd Webber here.
Yeah. It's an interesting question. I think there's a lot of cultural forces that kind of conspire to make these two musicals happen. And first, generally, like, musicals tend to compete. Like, there were two Phantom of the Operas in development at the same time. Like, that's a thing that happens. I'm sure on this podcast, you've dealt with, like, The Illusionist versus The Prestige. There's, like, four Pinocchio movies coming out this year. So I think that's part of it. Another part of it, though, is I think that into the late 60s, and musicals take a while to develop, but there's a real cultural interest in reappropriating or rethinking about Jesus as a force for social justice critique, for cultural critique. I mean, there's a lot of forces that I think conspire to make that happen. Like, Second Vatican Council happens in the late 60s, mid-60s, and it's kind of weird how we've sort of forgotten as a culture, how influential that was. It's sort it was the moment the Roman Catholic Church sort of like thought about, well, these masses should be celebrated in the vernacular and that sort of thing. Got The Lost Temptation of Christ translated into English in 1960. You have the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi Scrolls discovered. Like, there's an interest in reconfiguring what these things mean for us as a culture. And I think these musicals come out of that interest, that sort of the Jesus movement was emerging as a thing. There, the Jesus freaks out in the streets handing tickets out for God, right? Like, there was kind of a Christian component to the hippie movement that I think disappears. Even like the Pasolini just made The Gospel of Matthew, like 1964. Unibrow Jesus. Have you guys seen that one? like these homoerotic images of Jesus as like a person engaged in cultural critique. And I think that these musicals emerge from that interest, for sure.
I also think it's worth saying that there's the dorky Christian music that was still popular, like Peter, Paul, and Mary, like the kind of coffee house Christianity. The Birds, Turn, Turn, Turn is just the Bible. You know, like, there is that. So it's like, maybe that was moving slowly towards rock in its own way.
And I think that the nihilism that comes out of, I mean, like, Vietnam, eventually people do want to see something hopeful again. I was thinking, as I was rewatching Godspell last night, like, in what ways is the musical Hair influencing this, and in turn, is this movie influencing Hair, right?
Like,
which is also interested in sort of this occupation of New York as being a way to critique the system.
There's also a reason Ted Neely is in both of them, right? Like, it's very much a crossover.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think the culture was ripe for this kind of interesting reconfiguration of a figure that always feels like he belongs to the people in charge.
Right? I like sure. that you brought up Vatican II, because what was interesting to me with both these movies is who decided to boycott what, like who took offense to things, because the Vatican was very into Jesus Christ Superstar. Like initially they were like, we don't know how we feel about this. And then like the Pope came right out and said, it was like, I have screened it at the Vatican. We are down with this. We endorse it.
I love Pope movie endorsements. I will forever remember It Is As It Was, his endorsement of The Passion of Christ.
Did he put out the two a statement about the two popes? Because there is more than one. Did they have feelings about that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't think that they allow Ratzinger to talk anymore. I think he's in jail.
You just leave a plate in his attic and he scuttles off the ceiling to fetch
it. The man in the iron mask is who Ratzinger is right now.
All right. Well, let's get into our first movie, Godspell, because if you do a quick Google for Godspell Toronto, you're going to be surprised to see some of the names that appear in the cast credits of a legendary run in 1972 of the play. Now, in that cast were folks like Eugene Levy, Dave Thomas, Andrea Martin, Victor Garber, and Paul Schaefer. It's the production where Martin Short met his wife, Nancy Dolman, and Lauren Michaels first saw Gilda Radner. Now, of this incredible cast, it was only Victor Garber who was chosen to appear in the film version of the musical, reprising the lead role of Jesus alongside performers from the Broadway, LA, and Chicago runs. The more playful of the two movies today, it's the one that depicts a man's crucifixion where you'll leave uplifted and with a song in your heart. So let's get into Godspell. Cam, this plot is all yours. Good luck.
It's great.
Plot.
Series of parables we can all learn from.
I mean, they even kind of credit it as like question mark plot inspired by. So the plot as it is a John the Baptist type man appears in New York City and goes around town somewhat magically blowing his shofar and collecting the various disciples of Jesus, then or stand-ins for. He then baptizes them in Central Park, and then Victor Garber appears as Jesus. And from there, they kind of, they're a band of merry pranksters who go around in abandoned New York telling various parables. And it's interesting because they often tell kind of classic parables and then have Jesus comment on them and kind of show that tension. But they tell them in a way that's like, to me, I'm like, this is like Robin Williams performing the Bible. They love vaudeville. They love impressions. They love voices. Yeah, it's a real tough, if you're like a 90s kid, it's tough to consume this as intended without irony.
The kid said, pretty cringe.
But it's almost like, I almost respect that it is so pushing it at you that it's like, you can only engage with the cringe. There's not really an ironic reading because it's pure earnestness in a way.
I think this movie really captures an element that I think gets downplayed a lot, which is Jesus must have been incredibly annoying.
Yes.
I think this thing really captures that. Yeah, it's adapted from the Gospel of Matthew, which is, I think of it as the bougie gospel. Like, you get the sense, as much as they're dressed like hippies, like, the message that comes across is very, like, pacifist Jesus, liberalist Jesus, like, pay your taxes, respect the law, please do not hurt these people trying to crucify me, right? Like, although as much as I say that, like, it's also it captures something that's very Markan, which is like, he just kind of appears. Like, literally, he's just on the shore. If he has, they say the name Jesus like twice, I think, in the whole thing. Once as a joke, like as a curse, but.
So if someone slaps you on your right cheek, turn and offer him your left.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
He just kind of appears. There seems to be, which I've never noticed before, it seems to take place in a day, right?
Yeah.
Like, they get baptized in the morning, and then he's dead at night. Like, and then the city just kind of swallows up the events, right? Like, we're in this scary, depopulated New York, and the last shot is that surge of the crowd sort of absorbing them back into itself. Not a super optimistic ending, actually.
No. Like,
yeah. Other than the song, yeah. Nice song.
Which all the music is really uplifted. So Stephen Schwartz actually doesn't like the film version. He believes it's too flower childy and it doesn't capture the anarchy of the actual play. And I can kind of see, like, this is a very odd choice for a film version of something where I am sure, like, the characters are in the audience with you. When you think about the people who were in the Toronto version, you're like, these are improvers. These are very big, broad performers. I'm sure the energy was electric when you're watching this. So you would be hanging on to the words of these stories and it wouldn't feel as preachy. It would be more like you're involved in this. Whereas this one, you're more of a bystander to it because you're not as into the world. Right. It's interesting.
Yeah,
I think that's generally something when you're adapting a musical to film that always becomes a problem. Like, the identities of these, as Cam was saying, like, the identities of who these characters are is very slippery in Godspell. Like, the John the Baptist figure becomes the Judas figure.
Yeah.
And I think on stage, that's fine because they're only... Actually, there's a character actually holding a puppet in this. And there is something Punch and Judy-ish about this movie where it's just like, they're not really people. There's this weird attempt to give them a biography at the beginning that is really just the identity that falls away once they're baptized. And then they just turn into Jesus's, like, parable puppets, right? Like, let's talk about the Good Samaritan and all this stuff. And I think that does, in contradistinction to, like, Jesus Christ Superstar, where everyone is very careful, like, the agony of that last week of Jesus' life is very carefully delineated. Here they just kind of, let's think about those stories for a minute. And I do think you're right that there would be something more anarchic and carnivalesque about it being in front of you on stage. There seems to be a lot of audience engagement, which I hate so much.
I mean, it's the same problem that the movie of Cats has, I think, where, like, the magic of Cats is that the cats are crawling all over you and stuff, and that the trash can flies over your head. It's not people in cat suits looking stupid.
Well, you can't not compare the two Jesuses, right? Because we're looking at Ted Neely and then two very different interpretations of the story, right? Like, here, this is joyous, and even when he goes to his death, he's joyous. Whereas you're seeing someone very much more in turmoil in Jesus Christ Superstar, which is being reflected in the two performances of Victor Garber and Ted Neely. Victor Garber is going for this. Like, number one, it's so nice to see Victor Garber, like, as a baby, like, baby. Because now he's one of those actors I always think of. I'm like, you've been, like, what, 48 forever? And then suddenly you were 90. Yeah. Like, that's kind of how that worked. And I see what you mean by, like, annoying, because he is just so ethereal in this.
Like, I was going to say, that's the weird thing, is he, like, these people seem more like real people, I think, than Jesus Christ Superstar, but he is more the magic, unearthly Jesus.
Down to earth kind of thing.
It reminded me of a Wii show on our channel as well, the Jesus of Nazareth with Robert Powell, and that one they worked very hard to never have him blink on camera. Zeffirelli's like, he's not human, he has to be inhuman, and I feel like Garber kind of gets that he's like, he is this kind of floating, odd character.
Well, then my question for you is, which Jesus do you prefer? Do you prefer inhuman, or do you prefer human and like ethereal and like not capable of wrong, but is going to his death and make those sacrifices for us because he knows he must, because for the greater good? Or do you prefer the deeply troubled, like, I am human, but I just happen to have this burden upon me, which is sitting in Jesus Christ Superstar? What's your Jesus preference in terms of the story?
I like a weirdo. I like I like a spooky. My podcast, we did the Gospel of Mark, and now we're on the Gospel of John, and they're both the spookier Jesuses. They're both the ones where he's like, whoop, he like disappears, and the crowd's like, where'd he go? Like, or like he forgets he has to eat sometimes, or like he's just like magic just kind of comes off, and like if you touch his robe, it's like, oh, I'm healed, and it's like he spits in people's eyes. Like, I like that. As a choice, I like a Jesus, but I like a Jesus who's tactile too, which this one is not, right? Like, he does have a kind of ethereal, angelic quality. I like a Jesus who has to spit in your eyes to cure your blindness and stuff.
Sure.
Like, jam, gives you a wet willy to cure your deafness. Like, there is something about that that I like. The biggest difference, of course, is that, and this is related to this problem of, like, emotional agony, is there's no emotional connections here, whereas Jesus Christ Superstar is all about the Mary Magdalene and the Judas of it all, right? Like, what, how do you relate humanly to something so inhuman and to a mission that has such far-reaching, like, epic consequences?
And do you believe this person is who we say they are, who they have imbued themselves with? Because the whole point of Jesus Christ Superstar is he keeps saying, I didn't say I'm this, you guys are saying I'm this, right? So, I mean, it's interesting to see the two things, whereas this, the Victor Garber Jesus is like, yeah, I'm Jesus, and I'm here to teach you, and, like, listen to me talk, whereas Jesus Christ Superstar, it's more of, like, I am having all this put upon me rather than I am putting it out.
Yeah, yeah. The reasons he dies are quite different too, right? Like, Jesus Christ Superstar is so interested in the political. I mean, it's based on the Gospel of Luke, so it's interested in explaining and engaging with Rome versus the empire, the kingdom of heaven that Jesus is trying to build. Like, it becomes about kind of absolving Roman authority for misreading the treasonous dimension of Jesus's message, whereas he comes across, because it's the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus is a rabbi, right? He's like teaching you through these parables about the law. He's teaching you how to be a good person and a good Jewish person specifically. And he dies in this for challenging the weird Pharisee Voltron that he fights on the boat, right? The final boss of this movie is that scary puppet.
I mean, I love that part. That part's like The Wiz. That's where it's like, oh yeah, this is always kind of like The Wiz, but then there's a weird monster. Yeah, I also heard a great, because I just found a debate between kind of two people who are religious and which movie they liked more and blah, blah, blah. And the one guy said, like, he doesn't like that there's like so little Judas, that Judas is just kind of like an afterthought here. But the other guy was saying he enjoys that because he imagines that this is depicting a Christ who was so single-minded in his preaching that he essentially is ignoring the discontent amongst his followers, and that the crucifixion kind of sneaks up on him because he's just not paying attention.
I mean, what both films have is, I mean, I think it's funny, but the musicals are where you get engagement with him as a teacher, right? Like, over and against the kind of pathetic, like, pious versions you get from made for TV, or like The Passion of the Christ, where it's like, you're not going to get anything about actually what he believed or what he did. It's,
or like, even like the hyper criticism of like The Last Temptation of Christ, right? Like, where it's just like total tongue in cheek of
The Scorsese arc is interesting. Because that's another one where it's like he's screening Silence for the Pope recently, right? Like the Jesuit movie. I actually feel like if you want a good sense of what these Gospels are like, these movies are actually great adaptations of them, up to and including for Jesus Christ Superstar. Like, they retain the encoding of like the anti-Semitism of that Gospel, right? Like, there's the crowd being like, blame us, it's fine, don't worry about it. Like,
well, these are both musicals, as we mentioned. How do we feel about the musical sequences here? Now, we've already brought up The Wiz once. Anthony actually brought up The Wiz earlier. And I mean, that's because this is like New York with large friendly letters. Yeah. They're on top of the Twin Towers dancing. They're in Central Park. They're in Times Square. That Times Square, all the best sequence, is my favorite of this film. I really enjoy that.
Sure.
How do we feel about the music here? Does it fit? Does this need to be a musical?
I mean, yes, because there's so much music. And also, I feel like the music's the best part. Like, if we were just left with these impressions doing, I can't even think, weird vaudeville voices, I kind of hate it.
And after coming up, growl, 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 growl. Oh, oh.
But yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. The David Green, the director, who we haven't mentioned much, is like he was an actor. He was a RADA guy. And the interesting thing is, this is kind of his big feature film. But what he went on to do was Roots and Rich Man, Poor Man, the big TV movies of the 70s. But yeah, he was very into avoiding it being theatrical. That's why quite a lot of the cast is not the original cast, other than one of them is Maria on Sesame Street, so she could do it, and one of them had tonsillitis, apparently.
It has a real Sesame Street energy.
We're you know what? About it does. Follow That Bird later this season, and I can confirm that.
I mean, great. It's quite interesting. But yeah, it's, I do like the dancing. I do feel like when they get into like a musical number, whereas Jesus Christ Superstar feels more like a traditional musical. When they get into the singing and dancing, it's great. And it's worth saying, like, Victor Garber, he was you know, before this, I don't know if you guys know, he was a relatively successful folk singer in this band Sugar Shop, which is like the Canadian Mamas and Papas, which I suggest looking up on Ed Sullivan if you like him in a weird suit.
And does he have this big hair?
God, I love the hair.
Yes,
the hair.
Even bigger, maybe. Yeah. And a lot of great suits. There's a great, their album cover, he's in like a green, like a lime green suit with a cravat. I really recommend it. So I do like it when they get into the songs. And the weird thing is, I do think, we'll get into it, I think I prefer the songs generally from Jesus Christ Superstar. I think that's maybe a better musical, but I'll be damned if Day by Day was not in my head all week, you know, like that is the one that was the earworm.
13 on the Billboard Top 100 and stayed there for weeks. Like, it was a big hit.
Wow.
I find that I like Beautiful City a lot. I love that song. And I love Turn Back, Oh Man. I love the slinky, sexy film noir femme fatale chanteuse. Sure. Quality to that one. I've been like,
Beautiful City was written
week.
For the movie, though. It was not in the original TV show or not the original play.
And I didn't realize how much, I mean, going to your question about the New Yorkiness of it all, I think it's about New York in a way that I didn't think about before. And I don't think, as much as it uses the cinematic beauty of the city, I'm surprised in rewatching it how much it seems to be critiquing the city. I sort of talked earlier about the way the city just swallows him up at the end. This body, they turn a corner with his body and they disappear and the crowd surges and swallows it up. But even the Beautiful City sequence, like that song is so much about like, not a city of angels, but finally a city of men, right? Like, let's build something human. Let's build something socialist. Let's build something beautiful for each other. And they're walking past the Bethesda fountain, right? Like, the big thing I really forgot about is just how central the World Trade Center is in this movie.
And
like a scary prophetic way, actually. Like, the scene that's in both Gospels and both musicals is the scene where Jesus says, alas for you, Jerusalem, right? This generation will see your temple fall. And in this movie, he says that in front of the World Trade Center. That's like a wild accident of history to see happen. But I do think that that's the critique it's making, that like this center of empire, this center of capitalism does not take care of its people, is not interested in these kind of weird vaudeville hobos that are running around critiquing it.
I mean, I'm just fascinated. A fact I didn't know is that in a lot of the 9/11 memorials, apparently Beautiful City was like a constant thing that was played. That song was kind of recaptured.
A fantastic misreading of what that song's about,
But on stephenschwartz.com, there's like a great thing where like they've just kind of captured these letters people have written to him and then his responses to the letters. I'm not sure if they're physical letters or emails, but and often people are actually asking about reevaluating this film post 9/11, if that's something Stephen Schwartz has considered, of like redoing this film and taking those parts out because they make people uncomfortable. And I was
they should make people uncomfortable. I understand it's like a horrible event, but like, there's a reason that All for the Best song climaxes atop the World Trade Center, right? Like, because All for the Best is Jesus's message being countered to people who live for wealth, right? Like, that's what the John the Baptist character is in that vaudeville patter is singing about, right? Like, All for the Best is a double meaning, right? Like, it's all for the best in the weird liberal Jesus thing where it's like, the world will be fine, and all for the best is in all the good things go to the best, quote-unquote best people, right? Like, living in their pools and atop the World Trade Center. So, like, I'm interested in how the film does that. And I do think, going to the question of musicals, what's neat about the film is the way it uses song to kind of capture what Jesus must have been, which is like an entertainer, right? Like, you go to listen to the crazy guy outside of town who's telling these interesting stories. The parables
are interesting.
Well,
it's like revivalisms, right? Yeah. Like, that's the point.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what it was. And like, the parables always have this twist, right? Of like, it's not like the good man just like you who helps the beat up person. It's the Samaritan. It's the person you hate, right? Like,
or even the prodigal son. The prodigal son is one of my favorites because it's such a complicated story, right? And I remember my dad telling me that story when I was a kid at one point. And then I actually think he got it wrong because he's like, no, it's the son who said that he was going to do the thing. It's not the other son. And I was like, No, but it's the... Wait, hold on. Can we go back? But I think that's why these stories are so powerful, because they can be interpreted in so many ways. That's why we still sermonize, right? Why we still have to have the Bible interpreted to us. It's fascinating. And I think this film does a really good job of presenting it, and Jesus does comment on it, but there's not sermonizing. Like, it's not telling you what to think. It's putting it out there and being like, this is what the story is, and this is what we're told about it, but I'm not going to tell you this is the prodigal son is the right one. Do you know what I mean? It's really interesting to me.
It performs it, and it, because, as you said, like, it's not actually Jesus saying them in this. It's the vaudevillians are telling the story. So it becomes an act of community interpretation, right? It becomes like, how does this story make meaning? What does it mean that the laborer who arrives in the last hour gets paid the same as the guy who's been working all day? It becomes like, we as a community make this into something. Like, when you talk about sermonizing, like, it's actually about community building. I think that's really a neat part of this musical that Jesus Christ Superstar simply doesn't have. He has no parables in that whatsoever. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think John Michael Tebelak, who wrote it, he talks about how there's no resurrection at the end, partially because he considers the resurrection to be like a metaphor. Like, the resurrection is the word being passed on through his followers. Like, you don't need a resurrection. There are a million Jesuses because that's the people.
But that's also interesting. That's a criticism of both these films, is that they don't show the resurrection, and therefore there's no joy. They end on the downbeat. So people, and I'm like,
criticism
I don't think
to
so.
Then is pretty cool to me. Also, I feel like both of them end before 3 days. You know, what are we going to sit around for 3 days?
Yeah.
Come on.
There's like also a little like time card.
That's a criticism of the Gospel of Mark too. Like Mark ends where they go to the tomb. The last line of the Gospel of Mark is they ran away terrified because the women go to the tomb and it's empty. And that's it.
Oh, that's it. That is spooky.
So like I think a lot about Kierkegaard, who said, like, you can't say anything interesting about the resurrected Jesus because you're not in a position as a human being to understand it. It is the work of a lifetime. It is the work of the Christian life to get to the end and understand what that means. And I think what both films capture is, like, what is actually the real human experience of, like, what am I supposed to do with this? Like, you say these things, you lived this life, and now what? What do I do with it? As much as the resurrection is important to Christian thinking, it's not the part that's, you either believe it or you don't. It's the other stuff that's hard to get a handle on, right?
It's also that you died like the rest of us. Are you, were you something more than just someone who had some interesting ideas that we all wanted to chew on, you know? Like, that's
interesting. Do you think you're what they say you are?
I was also going to say, like, imagine how bad the resurrection would have been in Godspell. It would have been like streamers and everybody putting on voices. We don't need any more of that.
A Frankenstein bit.
Yes. And Igor, for sure, that one guy.
The moments where Godspell is theatrical, like, for example, during the crucifixion, where, like, it's very clearly, like, how they would have had it on a stage, where, like, there's the fence and then you just see the cop cars in the background, right? Versus how filmic and cinematic it becomes, like, on the Twin Towers or, like, dancing on those rails in front of that thing in Times Square. It's interesting to see the moments where they choose to go back to the theatricality versus lean into the cinematic and what the power of those two things are. Because I'm almost wondering, like, do you have to go back to the theatricality, that moment, because it's too hard to sit? Like, isn't for a movie that's so joyous, it's too hard to sit in, like, the realism of that crucifixion, if that's the case?
Yeah,
maybe.
I wonder if the film, I mean, going back to this kind of the way the film weaponizes landmarks, like, imagine if they did the crucifixion at, like, a notable New York man landmark, right? Like, that would be almost two on the nose in terms of critique. Like, every time you walk past, you're like, that's where they crucified Jesus.
Yeah. I don't know. It's interesting. I weirdly, this week I was engaging with a lot of New York stuff. I saw a big, like, short doc on Wheatfield, a confrontation. Do you guys know that? Where the woman built the whole Wheatfield in like downtown in the financial district.
Good,
it's like a big middle finger to the financial district in the early 80s. Yeah, it's great. Just a giant Wheatfield. But then also I watched the new West Side Story, which is very much about, like, gentrification and kind of pre this era. But it's interesting because also engaging with New York is, this is right before the kind of famous Ford to New York drop dead, where, so, like, New York is also going bankrupt. It's like a non-functional government at this time. So yeah, it kind of feels like you could do whatever, and it kind of felt like New York was on its own. So it is kind of surprising. It does feel like you could have had a crucifixion in front of the mayor's or something. Yeah.
It's also, I found it really interesting how it doesn't, like, they purposely walk past St. Patrick's Cathedral, right? Like, there's a moment where they're talking about in the Good Samaritan priests, and one of the vaudeville actors literally makes the sign of the cross, and I'm like, wait a minute.
Like, but then that also takes you out of time and place, too, right? Yeah. Which I think is very interesting. Yeah.
To me, I almost feel like the opening of this one should be the opening of Jesus Christ Superstar, which is a bit more magical, and the opening of Jesus Christ Superstar, where it's all like performers getting off a bus, putting on a costume, is more Godspell, you know? Because it's more more like, they're more like, they act a bit more like people who are contemporary telling you what's up.
You are not wrong, Cameron.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, it's weird. Godspell is also the weird one, it should be said. There's musicals like Milos Forman's Taking Off is kind of in the same vein. So there are these sort of theatrical musicals. But it's important to think that we're coming into 73 with both Norman Jewison's Fiddler on the Roof, which is a very like presented as if we're in the shtetl, and Cabaret in 1972. So like two massive financial and award successes that presented a very non-stagey musical, like a very cinematic, historical musical. Mm-hmm. So Godspell being theatrical and weird and hippie-ish is very out there. And it was the much less successful, other than the music. It was borderline a flop. It made its money back-ish. But compared to Jesus Christ Superstar, it was not a hit.
I think it's also that you see a lot of these people had who were in the film had enormous careers on Broadway and through musical theater, but none of them went on to do anything else film-wise, with the exception of Victor Garber. And I think there's
Lynn Thigpen, the chief,
yes,
please.
Yes, exactly. The chief herself.
My bad. Sorry.
Everyone's favorite. But Lynn Thigpen's first musical, which is pretty shocking, apparently, is Godspell. Yeah, I don't know. It's and the Jerry Sirocco, the one kind of handsome bearded man who does horrible
voiceover
impressions, is a voiceover. Yeah, voiceover king, not surprisingly. The impression is, like, as much as it can be annoying, all of them are pretty fantastic. And you don't see a lot of lady impressionists, which there are a couple here, which is kind of pretty impressive.
I mean, you were talking about the sort of thinness of it. It does have the effect of kind of like a hippie, like a happening, like, you know what I mean? Like, it has the kind of culture jamming thing. Again, the depopulated New York, but also just like the experience as an audience member of it is perhaps not the ideal capitalist audience experience of, like, occasionally I'm like, this is boring. Like, this is tedious. This is weird. This is off-putting. And there is something about, like, does that off-puttingness do a kind of work interests me in some weird ways?
There's a Brechtian aspect to the music. Yes. Like, for example, Day by Day comes out of nowhere, and she just says, "My Lord," and then starts singing, and you're like, "Sorry, what?" And this is like the banger of the movie. You know? It's really interesting. So you're jarred but pulled back in at the same time. So reverse Brechtian it would be, technically.
And I think that it's worth saying that both of these films, and we'll probably get into it more in the next one because it suits it a bit more, both of these films are very effortlessly diverse. And also, I think, sexy. Like, this is a hot, sexy cast in both movies. Whether or not you like a weird big afro, I think Garber has some horny energy. And I think, everybody's young and sexy and cool in both casts.
They're both very gay, too. Like, they're very queer. Like, in Beautiful City, he's skipping and holding hands with John/Judas, right?
Yes. Him and John have some real tension. Yes. And we know that Victor Garber is a gay man, so maybe there's, I don't know.
There's something.
But I mean, that
there,
also leans into the betrayal, too, right? Like, I think that's part of it. So.
That's where I think, like, the Judas stuff is thinly done, but that guy who portrays John/Judas is so good. He's so hurt when everything
David
goes
Haskell,
wrong with him.
He's excellent.
He has an excellent. It's consistently him who's the angry one, right? Like, the movie has to take a pause while he absorbs the turn the other cheek doctrine, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's an anger in him. Speaking of a sexy moment, like that one where Jesus slaps him and he moves to slap him back. And then he does a little vaudeville thing to get him out of it.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work. And then, I mean, really the most upsetting dissonant moment in the whole movie for me is when he's about to betray Jesus and he starts singing that circus. Dun, dun, da, 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 dun, dun, da, da, and it like doesn't work and it sounds horrible and it's really off-putting. And it's like the magic, the kind of carnivalesque of it is sort of dissolved. I love that so much.
Yeah, again, and I'm sure on stage that moment will be so incredibly powerful, right? Because you're in with those people and they've been so joyous around you, and then you can feel that emotional shift in the room, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's one of those, it's why theater is different from film and why we still continue to go to theater, and film didn't kill theater. Yeah. Video didn't kill the theater stuff.
And it's why nobody watches the Godspell movie, but teenagers are forced to perform Godspell 90 times a year.
It's because it has a big cast and lots of women. They do Godspell. All right. On that note, I just want to leave us with perhaps a little bit of a spoiler for Ebert. I love when Ebert gets catty, because in his review of this, he says, in deference to the several readers who didn't like my review of The Last of Sheila, written by Stephen Sondheim, interestingly, because I gave away too much of the plot, I won't reveal what happens to Christ in the end. I'm like, well, guys, we totally ruined that one. So let's move on to Jesus Christ Superstar, the more thoughtful and sad version of the two, I think. Although, man, I am so in love with this musical now. That's coming up after the break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
When my mother found out we'd be talking about Jesus Christ Superstar on the podcast, she got extremely excited. Now, I knew she'd enjoyed this as a teen and saw it multiple times on the big screen in 1973, but what I didn't know is that she also had multiple versions of the soundtrack on vinyl, can discuss the lyrical content in detail, and did a compare and contrast to the events of the Bible to the interpretations made by Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice. She has very strong opinions about Jesus casting, Ian Gillan in, Ted Neely out, and through a lengthy discussion with her, I think I now love this movie and the musical very much and will be watching it again probably more than once to pick up on more of the nuances. Does this one tickle you, Anthony? Is this a good one for you?
Oh, this one's in my bones. Like, I know this one backwards and forwards. I love, 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 love this musical. I think it's one of the, first of all, I think it's one of the like best things Andrew Lloyd Webber ever did, which is high praise.
The man knows how to write a tune. Like, they are catchy AF. Like, regardless of, he is a human being. Yeah. Yes, he's a stick a pin in it guy right now. But you can't deny that, like, Memory is one of the greatest songs ever written.
No, you would be crazy. And it's, I also think it's one of the most sophisticated engagements with the philosophy and the politics of this story, again, over and against kind of the more pious, careful versions of it. I like that it's willing to put its foot out and say something occasionally bold and audacious. And I think it captures sort of the desperation of this like last week of Jesus's life.
And how tired they must be. And the concept of the demands on everybody.
Yeah. Sweaty, sunburnt. Yeah, these guys all look exhausted.
Which I like, because it's it leads into like why everyone is making the decisions they make. Like, this, I think, is the most clear I've ever seen of like why Judas is betraying Jesus. And he's doing it for not out of greed, which is how you so often see it. It's because I think I'm doing something for the greater good. Like, it's such an interesting take on everything.
Oh, and everyone is fraught. I like that too. Like, you see that, like, Caiaphas feels bad that Jesus is crucified. Like, just about nobody wants him to be crucified, which is kind of wild too. It's so they humanize like every single mini character in a way.
I like the idea that that most boycotters here were just pissed at the idea that Jesus would sing at all.
Like, sure.
That's so fascinating to me. Jesus doesn't sing. It's like, well, what do you think you do in church? Like, it's
sounds like
weird.
You've never been to a synagogue, my friend.
Yeah.
A lot of singing.
Do you want to walk us through a little bit of the plot here, Anthony? Just, I mean, obviously we know, but like, kind of, what are the differences between the two, right?
Yeah. So Jesus Christ Superstar is based mostly on the Gospel of Luke. I called the Gospel of Matthew the bougie gospel. when we were talking about Godspell, the Gospel of Luke is very much the social justice gospel. It's the one, for example, when they did the Beatitudes in Godspell, it was blessed are the poor in spirit. When they do the Beatitudes in Luke, it's blessed are the poor,
okay.
Right? Like, that's the kind of difference between
that's
these
a
gospels.
Big difference, though. Like, that's a big,
yes, exactly. but Luke is also written for a more Gentile audience. It's pitched at people who are Greek or Roman, who are interested in the Jesus movement. And as a consequence, its emphasis is more on absolving Roman power, which is why this musical is much more interested in Pontius Pilate. It's much more interested in putting Herod on stage as the kind of evil king of the Jews who needs to be contradistincted to Jesus. And it's the last week of Jesus's life, basically from Palm Sunday when he arrives in Jerusalem, into Holy Thursday when he causes the incident at the temple that necessitates his crucifixion. And that's the story that it tells, from like the priests trying to deal with this kind of insurrectionist who has arrived in the city capital, knowing that it is putting a lot of pressure on the Romans to get rid of this treasonous element. And it sort of uses, in an interesting way, its protagonist is not Jesus, but Judas, as this figure who recognizes, is a part of this movement, but recognizes it has crossed some lines and now eventually feels like he must betray this figure to save his people. And that's the story that this weird, wild, again, hippie-ish, but kind of disco too,
very
right?
Disco.
It looks much more forward than Godspell did, right? Like,
yeah.
Jesus Christ Superstar is definitely like a disco roller skating.
The soldiers
kind of
are in lavender tank tops. That is like the one thing I could not look away from.
True. And I love, like, I love Judas, if it was, like, not dusty and looked like he'd been living in it for 10 years, his outfit would be quite a disco outfit, too. But, yeah.
Especially that last one for the final number.
Oh, that's true, like, too. The Jesus Christ Superstar, like, long.
One of the reasons I love watching musical theater performers perform is because there is such a power and endurance to what they do that they make look effortless. And I don't often like to compare things, but it was really interesting to me and enlightening because, like I said, I got very into the music here. And the Carl Anderson performance is unbelievable. Like, unbelievable. He doesn't miss a beat, especially when he does Jesus Christ Superstar, which is like the greatest song. Like, it's up there and like one of the best musical theater songs ever written. Just like with all the, I love, like, Sondheim does this so well, where I love where the lyrics don't match the upbeatness of the song. And like when you start to like really look in the lyrics, you're like, oh, this is some dark, serious shit. And then like it's like super sing-alongable in the car. And I saw Tim Minchin do it. Tim Minchin is, I'm a huge fan of Tim Minchin, but I was watching him do it and I was like, oh, this is a hard song to sing. Because although Tim Minchin is an excellent singer, he couldn't keep up with like the breath control that's required and the power in those moments, and the backup singers were out singing him. So it was one of those things where I was like, oh, I can really respect how incredible this song and how incredible these performers are that are doing this on this scale, which feels cinematic. So yeah, it makes sense to me why this went from a concept album that no one wanted to fund into a musical, into like stage performances and then the musical, and then the film. Like, that's really interesting. It makes total sense that this would just live and die based just on the music.
And can you illuminate me, Becky? I got a little confused in the like genesis of this, pun intended, they were kind of developing the film and the stage musical simultaneously.
That's what happened.
Right?
So Norman Jewison was given a copy of the music by Barry Denon, who was
The, like,
that's
concept
correct,
album,
yes,
right?
Who was doing Fiddler at the time, and he voiced Pontius Pilate in the concept album, and then would go on to play it in the actual film itself. So he gave this to Norman Jewison, being like, hey, you're doing a musical now, this might interest you, and he was like, I love this, and part of the reason why the stage production got made was because the movie was so championed by Norman Jewison, who had just knocked out Fiddler on the Roof. So that's part of it.
I mean, it's very fascinating, because it also sounds like, when I've only seen it on stage, it's interesting because it's referencing the movie, as far as I can tell, right? Like, quite often the everyone's dressed like those big hats and stuff. And so, yeah, it's interesting that the movie kind of invented a lot of, whereas I was like, because I kind of wrote down, like, you know, because I'm dumb and didn't do my research first, I was like, both of these are trying to do like a black box theater thing. But it's like, Norman Jewison decided to make a movie a black box theater thing. And that's why Jesus Christ Superstar is kind of an on girders. Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah, it's I love the way this movie is just kind of almost the opposite take to a similar effect as Godspell, where it's like squatting in these ruins, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a weird way that it feels between that and the sort of opening where they're getting off the bus, it feels like we're watching ghosts who have to like rehearse over and over again these events from 2,000 years ago, right? Like they're kind of possessed by these entities, and then they perform this weird ritual act where they leave him behind, and then they get back on the bus at the end, right? There is something very alarming.
It's sad and painful, but you get so caught up in it, you forget that, and that's kind of the magic of a like really good movie. Like when you watch like a tearjerker, you don't go in going like, oh God, I hope I feel sad. You go in because it gives you a human experience, right? And that's what brings you into it. And I think that's what this does really well. Fiddler does
I
the
also
same
think
thing.
It's
Fiddler
worth saying
is like
that,
incredibly sad.
Yeah,
you know, you get great moments of
emotional,
joy. Like,
yeah. And also, I think two things that these do compared to Fiddler and Cabaret that are interesting is these are both tight 100-minute movies. These both are not afraid to cut songs and streamline and make it a feature-length film. So I think even if I'm annoyed by Godspell, it's in and out, and I'm humming the tunes. And the same one here, where I think it's like this one is kind of a more emotionally impactful because it's such a quick telling. Like if you went epic in 2.5 hours, you might be a little less.
You
be
also
more fat.
Would be like, I've been trying for 3 years. Seems like an indie.
I don't know. And I mean, I love that when you're talking about those locations and those ruins, I was fascinated to read that, like, you know, each of these ones has like a biblical importance where they're like, they think this cave is where David waited to like meet Goliath, and this weird ruin is whatever from the Bible. It's like, that's amazing. That's actually. And I don't think that happens even much in the real staid tellings of the life.
Here's one of the things that's like really interesting to me, just in terms of cinematic history, is that this was very much funded by the newly established Israeli Film Center, who really like who kind of struck a deal with Norman Jewison, because if Norman Jewison went out and like took out Variety ads and things about how great it was to film in Israel, they gave him access to all of these places and did a bunch of funding. So if you kind of look at it, you're like, oh, this is also how Golan and Globus of Canon Films would have later have gotten funding for their stuff, because the Israeli Film Center funded so much of their things. So like this is really instrumental to American film industry as well. Like you don't have Canon Films and all that without it.
And of course, Golan and Globus would go on to barely pay attention to Godspell and
that
make the
correct.
Apple, which is basically like a weird version of
that
Godspell.
That is correct. I totally forgot that. It's Thank you, Cam.
But you're right.
Killed Disco. Yeah.
Yes.
God bless. I just screamed that the other day.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's why I thought of you, because I was like, oh, yes, famous Israeli film, The Apple. But yeah, Lemon Popsicle, their big movie, came out in 1978, which is Americans know it was remade as The Last American Virgin, but Lemon Popsicle. So you're probably right, and I mean it's good and bad, obviously. Feelings about Israel
That's
are
true.
complex, but there's interesting stories where there was a day they went to film and all the electricians weren't there because they're all in the army and they had to go fight
oh
a battle which is
wild.
A little crazy.
And the film is thinking about that stuff, right? Like we see the tanks, we see
the planes
planes going by. Yeah, like again, there's the same. They both really hit. Both films really hit hard. The speech Jesus gives, because of course both these gospels are written after the temple falls in 70 CE, and Jesus has a moment in both where he predicts that fall. There's the song in this one where Simon the Zealot is singing about like, there's must be over 50,000 screaming love and joy for you. Add a touch of hate at Rome, right? Like Simon and Judas want Jesus to be a political figure. They want him to be the revolutionary that they've been waiting for. And he won't do it because he foresees the kind of the fall of the temple, the what that action will lead to. And again, it hits as like a very powerful, mournful moment in this film when he turns that melody against them. And it becomes about like, this is what violence will lead to. And they're standing in this completely devastated, destroyed by the Bar Kokhba revolt, the putting down of that by the Romans. And this movie, one of the reasons it's haunted is because it has this odd foresight about it too. That I think is fed to it straight from the Gospels. And I find sublime in a lot of ways. Like you were talking about the kind of the difficulty of this musical over, like you can knock Godspell out in a weekend, right? Like one song per person, like we'll just do some somersaults and honk some clown noses and we'll be fine. This one's like four people have to hit notes you did not think a human voice could hit at both ends, right? Like when Caiaphas is down in the bass, it's like, oh my God, like I've never heard that sound.
Oh, sure, yes. We need a more permanent solution. I think it's funny because you talk about Godspell, a lot of those people didn't go on because I think they're more theatrical actors, they're more comedians, more that kind of stuff. Here, it's almost more that they're singers. Yeah. Like Yvonne Elliman, like she's amazing as Mary Magdalene. And it's also fascinating. She's like an Asian woman who's like a lead of a movie. But
and she was found for this. Yeah, like so, she was found in the UK singing in like a small pub by Andrew Lloyd Webber, who was like, hey, I got this stuff. Can you come like give this a go? And now she's Mary Magdalene. I mean, that, like, of course.
Yeah. And so you kind of get that like these guys didn't go on. They went on to various weird things. Like you kind of get that these guys were brought in for just this, even though,
It's very Park and Bark, right? Like that's what Jewison recognizes, I think, at a technical level he has to do in this movie is like, I'm going to stand Ted Neely on a hill while he hits a note you've never heard a human voice hit before, and I'm going to pan out to the craziest landscape you've ever seen in your life, right? Because it's not like this Jesus is not about to do a handstand or anything like Victor Garber might.
Yeah,
right?
Especially Jesus, especially his sad, sad, angry Jesus. But yeah, I love him, the number one as a film history person, the thing you always have to throw out is Norman Jewison, not Jewish. And again, he's coming along and being like, have you thought about the living world of Israel? Norman Jewison, you do it to yourself, man. Everybody thinks you're Jewish because you're like, he's like, a shepherd wandered into the frame, and I loved that, to think of living Israel. It's like, Norman Jewison, what are you doing?
I do want to talk a bit about the casting here, because we got into Yvonne Elliman. It's interesting to me, so Murray Head is the voice of the voice of Judas in the album version, and Murray Head, some people may not know, an excellent musical theater performer, also the brother of Anthony Stewart Head from Buffy. His version of...
He's One Night in Bangkok,
He's One Night in
right?
That was Murray his Head. Second big yeah, okay. hit based on a musical theater song, because those were his only Billboard hits were from musical theaters. So he did that. And then Ian Gillan from Deep Purple played Jesus in that version. And he was offered Jesus, but he didn't want it. So he didn't want to do the film because he was touring with Deep Purple, and he wanted to be a rock star. That's what he was, right? Okay. So they had to go on like a quest for Jesus, if you will, which they would do again in 2012 with a reality show in the UK.
Oh, I was going to say, make that a reality show in 2012
where they were going to do like an arena tour of Jesus Christ Superstar, and they did a thing. Don French was one of the judges. It's fascinating. Anyway,
a woman who
notoriously cannot sing so bad that she could not be in Mamma Mia in a non-singing role. Like that's how bad she is. She was one of the panelists. But that having been said, so they even looked at John Travolta, and apparently John Travolta did not get it, but that's what put him on Robert Stigwood's radar for Saturday Night Fever. So that's amazing. Interesting. But then Ted Neely was doing a production of Hair, and there was a number of people who were like, you guys need to see Ted Neely, or you need to see Ted Neely do this. Like, he can hit the notes.
And he was also in Tommy, apparently, like a stage version.
That's correct.
Of Tommy.
So he sent Norman Jewison tickets to come down and see it. And it was like he was driving, I think, from like the Palisades into like downtown Los Angeles. So, you know, an exponentially long drive, 2 hours. And so he went in to see him, and he had hurt his leg and wasn't performing that day. He just hadn't double checked. So Jewison was pissed. And so Ted Neely went to his hotel room and like dressed as Jesus with like fake facial hair. and knocked on the door and said, hey, I'm so sorry. I just wanted to show up and like do a quick audition and like see how you can see how I look like Jesus. Let me do this. And apparently he was charmed. And when he sang, he was like, yeah, 100%. This is what you're Jesus. Yeah, Let's do it.
A fascinating thing about the casting that I like watching it and then reading about the casting is that obviously from the film and he references it visually, he's obsessed with art of Jesus. And and I think it's very fascinating that Ted Neely looks a lot like an art Jesus. Like I think more than the kind of, you know, sad classical, I'm sure I've seen a Ted Neely hanging in church. And then also the fact that Carl, like he said, Carl Anderson, he said the racial stuff is just, he was the best guy and it's the best role. He's the best singer. But then also he suits so well so many depictions of the Last Supper, where Judas is usually a darker skinned fellow for metaphorical reasons.
Anti-Semitic reasons, racist.
And you name it.
Because that was something that struck me immediately too when I saw it. It was like, oh my God, they cast Judas as black. However, for me, that's also like, that is a very traditional telling of the story where all we see is Judas is as the betrayer. And here it's so much more of a complex character of why he does it and the remorse afterwards of doing it, adding that complexity to it, I think takes away from the racial aspect for me.
Oh, I also think that, it's like, you got to remember, number one, the cast is just completely racially diverse. You can tell it doesn't matter. Number two, you got to remember Norman Jewison was the king of black people casting. Like, that was his deal in the heat of the night as him. He was the guy who was going to make Malcolm X before he's like, Spike Lee should make Malcolm X. Like, Norman Jewison, I think, gets it and always kind of got it. You know, he was mindful of casting Judas as a black man, I think. And
its interpretation of Judas is so interesting to me because it is actually one of the biggest departures this film makes from the Gospel of Luke, which Judas is given different motives in the different Gospels, but Luke makes him greedy. That, like, it makes sense if you're doing the socialist gospel that the bad guy would be a figure of greed, right? Like, he wants money, he uses the money to invest in land, and he proceeds to explode somehow on that land. He, like, bursts like a blood balloon on the land. The film keeps the hanging part as the way he dies instead, which is from the other gospel, but adds so much complexity to his motivations, right? Like, not just the political one, but again, there's a bit of a queer vibe here too, right?
Like, he's jealous of Mary Magdalene for sure.
Exactly. And then
I also kind of love that there's a weird, like a very modern, like in the pandemic thing, I think, where he's so mad about the anointing and so mad about resting and so mad about, like, we can use that money for the poor. We should be working harder. And it's like, Judas, you don't understand self-care. Like, Jesus can't help these people. If his feet are sore, man, he's gotta anoint himself now and again, buddy.
My thing is that in that scene, you do see Judas's point, which I really love. But then you see when Jesus is being like pulled on by all sides by the lepers, and you're like, okay, I get it. Where, like, if you are a man and you are human, you just have this, like, you know, other aspect to you. I can understand why you are just so tired. Like, so everyone wants
suffering
to
from burnout, guys. He's suffering from burnout. He needs breathing exercises. Aren't enough, Judas,
and the knowledge that he's about to die, right? Which, like, Gethsemane, I think is like that song. I mean, that song's unbelievable to begin with, but like, it's like an incredible epiphany song. So not only is it a hard song to sing, it's like to act through all of those different emotions. Like, you're going through all the stages of grief in one song that's like 3 minutes long. It's bananas.
Yeah.
I will say, and I think just, I guess, to give credit to your mother, I do understand, I think something that both of these films do with the music, and especially for a rock opera, this one, they really favor the acting, and I think that they favor the enunciation to the point where sometimes the songs are delivered a little less, like, you can imagine a better version of these songs if they were really given it. And I think Ted Neely, what is great about him is the acting. But I can see that, oh my God. And he just looks miserable and tired. And also to know that these people, they had to hydrate every 20 minutes. I love that. They had giant blocks of ice to give them water. Like, it's everybody loved it and was like, it was great. But it's like, every story sounds awful. He's good.
Ted Neely also met his wife on this. She's one of the dancers in the cave. And he was...
Oh my God, that story is so beautiful.
It's beautiful. So at the very beginning, when they're all doing What's the Buzz, and this woman with this long dark hair was dancing ecstatically, and he was worried she was going to burn her hair because she was getting really close to the fire. So when they took a break, he came up to her and he said, excuse me, I need to And he stopped because they got caught in each other's eyes. And he was like, it was the most beautiful woman I'd seen in my life.
He's like, exactly.
And then this became his wife. And it's been his wife for like the last, like, what, 45 years at this point? They're still married. Like, I'm like, that's amazing.
And also, you're dressed as Jesus. I love that. Excuse me, ma'am.
It's in the show, too, right? Like, ma'am. The I Don't Know How to Love Him is really one of the best ballads ever written. And the fact that both Mary and Judas get a crack at it during the show is really amazing to me. Also, like, the S&M hotness of those priests is really amazing, too, right? Like,
true. Yeah, I mean, those are maybe the most attractive guys, unfortunately.
Yes! I want to come to I Don't Know How to Love Him just for a second, because this is something else that hadn't really happened up until this point, was that that song was on the charts at the same time by two different artists, both Yvonne Elliman and Helen Reddy. Helen Reddy's came out first, so it charted higher because, like, you're only going to buy one copy, right, of the two, and Helen's came out first. But Yvonne Elliman's is considered the definitive, even though Helen Reddy's is very good.
Yeah, I mean, that song is perfect, right? Yeah. Like, it's interesting how every character is trying to triangulate their relationship to Jesus' ministry, including Jesus. And like, and that one, it goes to what I was saying earlier when we were talking about the resurrection, right? Like, her question, although posed as like a romantic one, is the question of the show. Like, it actually is the same question as the Jesus Christ Superstar song, right? Like, what am I supposed to think about you? How am I supposed to relate to you as a person? Is this a romantic relationship? When you say I'm supposed to love you, what does that mean? Like, that's kind of the question she's asking. And that's why I think it's so beautiful that in the moment where he realizes by betraying Jesus, he has destroyed himself, Judas has this kind of strained reprise of it, where he has to perform that melody too. And then the demonic performance of Jesus Christ Superstar, where that question comes back as a taunt, right? Yeah. Like, is there a reason for me to be haunted by this ghost still in both directions?
We talked about the Beatles musical Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band in the first season, which I do love. And understanding Robert Stigwood's involvement here, and now having seen this and seen Sgt. Pepper's, I'm like, man, there's echoes of the two of them there. And it's the biggest echo is that Sgt. Pepper's doesn't have the same soul as this does, but it's going for the same story and message of, like, the redemption, and, like, these are people who have been tasked with something larger than themselves, and so seeing where it works in one and doesn't work in the other, and, like, it's very clear one influenced the other. It's very interesting.
So you're giving a lot of credit to that terrible film. I get it. Yeah. Yes. Perhaps if it was shot by Douglas Slocum, and it would look
better. They both have a weird thing where, like, they're about music from the 60s, but you can hear the 70s, you can hear disco forming, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it feels like disco is invented before your eyes in this musical. But, like, by the end, we've got the bangles and the fringes and the disco ball that is Judas descending from the ceiling.
And I mean, it's still kind of disco-y, but apparently the big departure he took from a lot of Jewison took was that Herod was a drag queen usually and a very over-the-top thing. But he kind of thought that that was maybe too far out of his interpretation and too distracting. So he went with Josh Mustel instead.
Did you hear the castings thing on this one? Where when Norman Jewison went through Zero Mustel first because he wanted Josh Mustel, and Zero was still pissed about not being in the film version. So he was like, if you're going to cast someone, cast Topple, son, because it's not going to be my son. Okay. He's so mad.
That's great. I think he's pretty good, but when you watch other ones, like, I don't know, Becky, you probably saw your best friend, religious man, Alice Cooper, play it, which was so good. And somebody sent in some of my research, there was a clip of Rick Mayall doing
it. Oh, I gotta see that.
As, like, a weird lounge lizard. Oh. And it's like, Josh Mustel is kind of missing something some of the juice. I don't know. But it's funny. It's great.
There's
looks great.
That works for me. Like, there's a way that the kind of fatuous idiocy of it makes a point, right? Like, this is what actual worldly power looks like, right? Because I don't think it's an accident, right? Because Jewison tracks back. There's a very distant shot where we're watching the dancers moving, and it looks bad, right? It looks silly. It looks impotent, which I think is the point.
He looks like almost Hugh Hefnerian.
I do like a scary
Yeah.
He's like Hugh Hefnerian in this version.
Yeah, yes. Sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I do like, I've seen this show maybe, I don't even want to count how many times on stage. And I do occasionally like a very, there was a recent production here in Toronto right before the Omicron wave where Herod was terrifying, okay. Right? Like he ran down the line. He was kind of a drag queeny kind of character, but like they very purposely evoke the beheading of John the Baptist, right? Mm. Which the Alice Cooper one does too, because he's wearing the suit with the Gentileschi print on it. But I kind of like, it's a choice this film is making, is like, what if he's not scary? What if he is the silliest thing you've ever seen? Yeah. And it kind of actually relieves the tension of the film for
a minute.
Things
that he's interpreted, which were, if we are to believe it, they were actually miracles, him turning them into parlor tricks, like the walk across my pool, you know, turn my water into wine, like the him making fun of it, but you're like, no, you're actually the asshole, right? Like, that's really interesting.
Yes. Right. Oh, yeah. And I think that what works is that Ted Neely looks like a man who knows he's about to die. So and he's just checked out entirely while this guy sings at him. Yeah.
There's only one character with dignity in that scene. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Herod was just waiting those 33 years to get him. You know, it was just a matter of time. Yes. It was coming.
Yeah. And I do think it's now, it's an interesting show that has changed, I think, over time. And now that is the, you know, that's the curtain call where you get a celebrity to come on and play Herod, because they only need to trot out for 20 minutes and sing a song that's pretty easy to sing.
All right. So, I gotta end us on this note, because I'm sure we could talk about these forever, because they're fantastic. So I just want to say thank you so much, Cameron Maitland, for being with us today.
Oh, thank you. And as I say, look up The Sugar Shop and Victor Garber's early folk music, because you'll enjoy those outfits.
I need to check that out immediately.
Anthony, thank you so much for joining us. First time on the podcast. It was such a pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This was such a joy. I love both these films, and this was a great conversation about them. I think that they are endlessly fascinating, but I think we did
a
good
job. In like the hour that we had, you know, I could easily talk about Jesus Christ Superstar. I think what's weird for me is that my mother is such a big fan of this, and she was such a big influence on like my cinematic education, like getting me stuff I really shouldn't have been watching, because she's like, you need to see this if you want to do this. And she never showed me this movie, and I do not know why. So it's
keeping it for herself. Didn't want you to ruin it.
It's her own little secret, because she's just thinking about Ian Gillan. She's not thinking about Ted Neely. Sure. That's why it's not her version. How can people find your work, Anthony?
Easiest place is probably on Twitter. It's Mia Koopa, which is a bad Latin church pun about Super Mario, or anthonyolivera.com. I've got a podcast where I talk, called The Devil's Party, where I talk about this very thing. We talk about the Gospels and how we should be reading them and what the heck they're trying to say, and that's on patreon.com.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. And you can join us next time, where we're going to look at two extremely psychedelic movies. And we'll be joined once again by the fantastic Kat Ellinger. It's Holy Mountain and Messiah of Evil. That's coming up in a couple weeks. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies and the series that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen. On 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland. And today featured Cameron Maitland and Anthony Oliveira as guests. Supervising producer is Emily Gagné. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.